Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to Extension 720, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight. We're happy to be on this beautiful day, this beautiful night in the Chicago area. Hopefully more of this to come this week. Tonight, we're titling this show By the Book. It's a loose theme to encompass all the stories and guests that we have lined up for you. Today, the Printers Row Lit Fest announced their upcoming lineup for the 35th year of this great Chicago Summer Festival, a festival that almost ended. But the original producers have returned to bring the festival back to glory. One of the original producers is Betty Cerf Hill. She's back in charge, and she'll join us to talk about how the festival has changed over those years. We have the stars of the highly anticipated summer comedy Booksmart in studio, the film, the latest in the high school party genre, and features two students who did everything by the book to get into college, only to realize they went their whole high school careers without having any fun. So they let loose. The result's hysterical. The movie opens up for limited screenings this weekend. Both Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Deaver will be in studio later in the show. Tonight marks the return of our resident philosopher, Al Genie. The business ethics professor has been asked a simple question for years. Professor, what's your favorite book on philosophy? And for years, he would say that question was impossible to answer. But Al has had an epiphany, and he's picked a book. He'll tell us why coming up at 8 o'clock. And if the NBA draft lottery goes by the book tonight, the Chicago Bulls will get the fourth overall pick in the draft. The big ping pong ball pageant kicks off. The Hilton tonight, 7:30. Our very own Mark Carman is there. Talk with him about the Bulls' hopes for a mini miracle in the Zion Williamson sweepstakes. It's a hard word to say. And we continue our neighborhood tours. Tonight we head up to Lincoln Square, a neighborhood that's seen a full-on transformation, thanks in part to a library. Conrad Sulzer and other institutions helps anchor a community that has grown exponentially in the last 20 years. So all that tonight on Extension 720. So go ahead, stay with us. Coming up this half hour, we're going to get to Mark Carman before the draft lottery begins, 7:30, the broadcast on ESPN. Before we do that, before we get to the show, a couple of thoughts on tonight's theme, By the Book. It is radio, so that could mean by the book, like B-U-Y, but not tonight. We won't be all pledge drive and try to get you to buy a book. Although if I ever write a book, get ready for that. I'm going to be relentless. It's going to be obnoxious. No, the theme tonight is by the book, as in following the rules. Rules and regulations, and as in, don't ask Pete for more time on this intro. He's by the book. And it's funny because in the film Booksmart, which we'll be talking about later, it's all about these two characters who live their high school lives by the book. If I do this, then I'll be able to do this, and then that will lead me to this. And it's not till they realize their premise is false that they strike out into the real world, in this case, the high school party, and find out that they're not as prepared to take on the challenges that lie in front of them. But it's a movie, so they figure it out and win in the end. Roll awesome credit sequence, right? It's the old adage, really. Is it better to be book smart or street smart? And that's the rub. Can you be smart without having both? You need to follow the rules so you can break the rules. You need to study the point of view of others so you can be confident in your own when the time comes that you need it. Which begs the question, what kind of life can you lead if you don't read books? Who needs them, right? That's what I say. Yeah, they smell great, but I've got Netflix. When's the last time you read a book, cover to cover? Kindle counts, I'll allow it. Obviously, this question will have different answers based on the age of who answers it, right? It's funny, my dad, he collects all sorts of books. It's a glorious day for him when it's his birthday or Christmas because he stocks up on used books about history, about geography, about, I don't know, Harry Truman's hat. If there's a book on his hat, my dad's probably has it. And in turn, he uses that information to be better educated about the world around him. Or to be a wealth of information at a cocktail party, which may be why my mom has recently tried to put a moratorium on the birthday and Christmas book hauls. But my dad's street smart. He grew up on the mean streets of Chicago. His parents died early. He had to drop out of high school. He was drafted into the army. He's the epitome of a guy with street smarts. He lived a life, persevered. He now has a master's degree. And he continues to use those books from Christmas and birthday and so on, to grow. I read a lot of books, but to be completely honest, they're mostly for work. Except the Motley Crue book, The Dirt, that was for pleasure. But most of the time, it's an author coming through town, so I need to do the research. But if you put a book in front of me that isn't required for this job, it'll collect dust on my nightstand. And I've never considered myself to be very book smart. As a matter of fact, I once skipped buying the book entirely for a college class. It was a mass media class. And I figured I could wing it. I knew broadcast. I was already working in Chicago radio. This was my last semester. And it took about 10 seconds for my professor to realize that fact when I answered one of the questions on the quiz with, "I don't know how you say it, but in my business it's called a voiceover." And then you go on to the next generation, I think about my 11-year-old son, who every night before bed is mandated to read for half an hour. And he gets into it. He's got the Series of Unfortunate Events collection for Christmas, and he read them in hours, really. Probably took him a month to get through the entire set, like 10 or 15 books. He loves books, but then again, it's homework. If anything, his love of books is by the book. But I find myself trying everything in my power to get him to put down the book. I know that sounds counterintuitive. To teach him how to make eye contact with the driver when he's crossing the street. To recognize what's happening on the block in front of us. To not let Chicago get over on him, and whatever that means. And to teach him, by the book? Well, whose book, exactly? And at the end of the day, that's the hope, right? That we find some sort of balance. To be smart in whatever way we need to be smart in that moment. And to buy the book, even though you think you're better than the professor. That's my story. And one last thought. My dad's birthday is coming up. And since he already knows all about Truman's hat, maybe I'll get him something on Roosevelt's mustache. I'm sorry, Mom. Stories and segments about the book, going by the book, and finding balance tonight on Extension 720. Book smart, 312-981-7200. If you're street smart, just tell me on the street. Extension 720 tonight coming up. Mark Carmen, as we get ready to see if the Bulls and Zion might be a match made in heaven. That's coming up. Stay with us.
You can't contain me, uncontainable. I do it without even trying. I'm feeling unstoppable, Zion. Driving the lane like I'm Zion. Shooting the tray like I'm Zion. Set up across you like Zion. Spinning around like I'm Zion. All the way up like I'm
Zion. Sweepstakes for Zion Williamson begins at 7:30 in 7 minutes. Mark Carmen is covering the festivities, the draft lottery in Chicago tonight. The Hilton Towers going crazy, I'm assuming, as Mark is there with the media and, of course, all of the NBA elite as they get ready for this big night, which is not about the playoffs. It's about the teams that didn't make the playoffs. Mark, good to talk to you, buddy.
Justin, good to hear your voice, brother. It is everything you just said. I did get a one-on-one with Zion. Unfortunately, he did not answer any of my questions. I asked him if he was excited. I asked him if he was nervous. He did not respond to me. He continued to take pictures with his many fans. So that's an 0 for 2, but it was I'm giving myself an A for effort.
You know, that's interesting that the players come out for this, or at least he does. He's such a big name, and for all our listeners who may not understand, Zion Williamson's the everybody believes he's a consensus number one pick, and franchises are lining up hoping the ping pong balls go their way because they feel he's the face of a future franchise.
Yeah, I mean, this is a LeBron James. This is a Patrick Ewing back in the day. This is a Shaquille O'Neal. This is a, this is a decade-long whatever. You wait for somebody like this to come out. All this stuff. I mean, these guys just don't come around every year. You look at the NBA draft. I mean, last year was DeAndre Ayton. I mean, he's okay, but certainly hasn't changed the fate of the Phoenix Suns. Zion Williamson's going to change the fate of some team tonight.
Okay, so they're doing this. This is the ping pong lottery. The balls bounce around, and they have the, you know, some of the teams have the jerseys ready, things like that. Are the Bulls seriously in contention for this? I know they changed the rules in which the way the lottery works, but is the front office, the brass, and the management believe they have a shot at the number one pick?
Well, so they've got a 12.5% chance, which is the most you can have is a 14% chance. So, given those odds, I mean, they're in the team photo. They have a 36% chance of being in the top three. And, you know, who's going to go second? John Morant, who's a sweet point guard that Bulls fans, Chicago will love. That would be nice. R.J. Barrett from Duke would be the third pick, which wouldn't be terrible. So the Bulls are in the mix. But, again, they're a coin flip to land out of the top four. And their most likely destination on any one pick, they have a 25% chance to finish sixth, which would mean that nobody be watching Bulls basketball again for the foreseeable future.
Mark, I've watched this ceremony before from the television, from the couch. I've seen this happen. Is it because it's in Chicago, it's a bigger deal? It seems like a bigger pageant, that there seems to be more about this this whole ordeal, this what's happening down at the Hilton Towers tonight.
I mean, I think it's all about Zion, Justin. You know, this guy is, he's breaking through shoes. He's jumping out of the gym. He's got a personality. He's a great kid off the court. Apparently, he loves to play video games and watch Netflix. I just think people just absolutely know that he's going to be great. And the Chicago thing, I guess it's a little bit, but it was, you know, it was here last year or 2 years ago. I don't even remember. And, you know, I don't remember there being a buzz like this, and the Bulls were super disappointed. It was last year, and they dropped down from their, you know, they went from 6 to 7 and ended up getting Wendell Carter Jr. So,
right.
You know, I mean, people don't even remember that. I'm going to remember this night. At least, I mean, I think others will too, if and when they get him or if and when they don't.
Okay, so, you know, the final question just being that the obviously the NBA cares a lot about what happens here, and they brought in a bunch of players, current players and past players, to represent. Who's representing the Chicago Bulls tonight when they talk about the Bulls pick?
So he's been drinking some vino. He looks a little nervous to me. But good old number 54, Horace Grant, is ready to roll. I feel good about that. I mean, Patrick Ewing is here for the Knicks. I asked him, you know, how are you feeling? He's like, well, why would I be nervous? So all I got to do is sit there and look pretty. So, but Horace, like, actually legit seemed nervous. Justin, like, he's like, I hope I can do it. Like, as if he's got some control. But I appreciate that out of 54. He wants to do it right. And, you know, the Reinsdorfs are here, Jerry and Michael, the whole scene.
Wow. All right, well, the show starts in 2 minutes. We'll let Mark Carmen get back to it. It covers the Bulls and WGN Sports for WGN Radio. Mark, thanks, and I guess go Bulls.
Go Bulls. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate you.
Thank you. There you go. Mark Carmen at the Hilton and Towers in Chicago for what he's right. I mean, what is obviously has a lot more buzz about the draft lottery than years past, even last year when it was in Chicago as well. This seems to be something bigger, and it is all about Zion and where he ends up. We'll update you in the news and of course, in the 7:30 block if and when the draft picks are ready to go. So, all right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk. We'll get the news and we'll talk a little Printers Row Lit Fest here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Thanks, Don. 312-981-7200 is the phone number of the show, Extension 720. Here on 720 WGN, I am Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Professor Al Jeany joins us, our resident philosopher. The question that he gets asked regularly, what is your favorite philosophy book of all time? And he usually says it's impossible to answer. But today, tonight, his inaugural voyage here on Extension 720, he says he's got an answer. So we'll talk with Professor Al Jeany, our resident philosopher here on WGN Radio, coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. At 9 o'clock, the stars of the movie Booksmart will be in studio. And we'll have that conversation coming up, as well as continuing our neighborhood tour Tonight we head to Lincoln Square. So that's all coming up tonight on Extension 720. Well, programming for the 35th annual Printers Row Lit Fest was announced today. Authors like Valerie Jarrett, Alex Kotlowitz, and playwright Eve Ensler will headline. The largest free outdoor literary showcase takes over the Printers Row neighborhood on the near south side every June. It's a tremendous achievement, bringing together booksellers and local and national authors for conversations under tents in the old Plymouth Court. Since 2002, the LitFest was produced by the Chicago Tribune. This year, the Trib is out. They're still hanging around as a sponsor. But the festival is back in the hands of the Near South Planning Board. And they brought back the LitFest, the book fair founder, Betty Cerf Hill, to run it. Cerf Hill and the Planning Board launched the Printers Row Book Fair back in 1985. The festival is a must-visit for any book lover. And it's not an accident that it takes place in Printers Row, an area that was once home to several independent printing presses in Chicago. Betty Cerf Hill is an artist. She used to have her own Cerf Hill Gallery in Westtown. She was given an Illinois Humanities Award back in 2012, and she joins me on the line now. Ms. Hill Cerf, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, but you've said it all. I don't have anything.
Well, let me ask you the question, just what does it feel like to get back in to produce this festival again, this festival you started 35 years ago?
Well, if you had asked me, theoretically, I don't know what I would have said, but actually it's sort of fun. It's great to sort of be back with the book-loving world and, you know, getting these amazing... Right now, Chicago is in such a terrific renaissance of writers of all kinds, but we've been able to get a lot of good Chicago writers, but also we've expanded it to including lots of different things like writers' workshops, a lot of proactive stuff, mm-hmm. and we have some plays that will be, I'm not, you know, just like readings of plays that are going to be produced by Steppenwolf and going to be produced by other places, and a little snippet of The Music Man from Goodman, and the Kids Parade is new this year. We're inviting parents to let their children come to the fair dressed in their favorite costume, or maybe just an old magic wand that they have lying around, or a hat, and
I love it.
Form a parade and walk around Dearborn Street.
Well, Betty, take us back to 1985 when you first started this festival. What was the intent, and what were we trying to accomplish with a book festival in Printers Row?
Well, we had done a lot of different things. We had had Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party. We had had Sculpture Chicago to bring people to the Near South Side. And so my husband said, why don't you have, you know, like booksellers, like the Mason? And I said, because it's Chicago. But we could try it one weekend. So we invited booksellers, and of course they didn't want to come outside with their precious books, but we told them that we would cover the books up with a tarp if it rained. So we had no idea what we were doing, but it was, you know, people came, and it was fun, and we closed the streets off, and it was quiet. People were looking at books, and then we had a few authors read, and then decided to do it the next year, and pretty soon, it was an annual event that people counted on.
It's a really great festival. I'm down there every year with the family, and I really appreciate it. And but as it moved on, when did you recognize you had something, that it was more than just the booksellers and really hardcore book lovers that were attending the festival?
Oh, I think within the first few years, it quickly became such a multi-stage thing. You know, early in the morning, the booksellers would buy from each other. That was a whole book fair on their own before the public even came in. And it, you know, people met each other and got married. Authors like, and then after about 5 years, we started the Harold Washington Literary Award. We thought we were making it classy. And does the name Milt Rosenberg mean anything?
Yeah, a little bit.
Do you know that he was on our Harold Washington Literary Award Committee?
I did not, no.
For many, many years. He was a very vital member of that committee. He was the only member who actually fought for their author. The committee members were asked to suggest some authors. He didn't just suggest.
He fought for it. That's great.
He fought for it.
Well, I love the festival, and like I said, it's a big part, and it has grown over the years, but it is interesting to see how the near South Side and the South Loop, as it's changed as a neighborhood, has continued to do this festival. You think about the library, the Harold Washington Library that's there, but you also think about the independent printing presses that I mentioned. They, of course, played a role in just developing a literary community in the South Loop. Talk about that.
Yeah, the reason that those buildings in Printers Row make good apartments is because they had big windows, and the reason they had big windows is so that engravers could use that light. So it really was a place where the printing not only started, but it was near the train station.
Right.
So the train would come in and take the printing away, distribute it all over the country.
As the neighborhood does change, and it's less of a central focus. I mean, there's so much going on down in the South Loop now. Does the Printers Row Lit Fest need the neighborhood, or can it be a different neighborhood's Lit Fest, or somewhere else, or is it always going to be a place that will be entrenched in Printers Row and in that South Loop area?
That's a very interesting question. A lot of the other big book fairs around the country are involved with universities. And for sure, the Near South Side doesn't need a thing like a book fair to bring people to it. But I don't know, some of us like the idea. It's a historic district on the National Register of Historic Places as a printing hub. And I think it's pretty special. And interestingly enough, I think most of the people, maybe not all, but most of the people who live in the neighborhood not only don't mind having their lives totally disrupted for a couple of days, they like it. They encourage it. So I would hate to see it leave that neighborhood. I can't think of any other place that would be quite the same.
Right. Betty Cerf Hill is my guest. She is running the Printers Row Lit Fest. The Chicago Tribune has just become a sponsor. They're no longer producing it. They handed it back to the Near South Planning Board. When you think about running a festival and to get back into it after these years, is it difficult? Is it challenging? Is it stressful? What does it take to put together a literary festival?
Well, luckily, a lot of the people who worked for the Tribune were available. So we have excellent counsel in Liz Taylor, who was part of the Tribune mm-hmm. for so many years and still is. But there's also Teresa Basso Gold, who did the programming, and we have other people who were involved with the Tribune. But then we also have old friends who date back from before the Tribune got it, who've been helpful, like New City. And it does take a lot of people and a lot of organization to do something that only lasts for 2 days. It's
That's
amazing.
Right.
'Cause I think we get, 100,000 people there, so it's really a big event. And we're going to have 8 stages this year and bring it more back to the street. So we're going to have a new big tent that we'll have programs in and over 100 booksellers, and then all sorts of other events and things happening, yeah. Food and fun.
Betty, the industry, the publishing industry when it comes to marketing and authors being able to go on tour, it's shrinking. I mean, you mentioned Milt Rosenberg. Extension 720 of his day, this was the place that they would book authors to come to Chicago because of Milt, but there was just a really healthy ecosystem for authors. Not as much anymore. So how do you get authors and other people in the book publishing industry to continue to come to Chicago to be part of a Lit Fest when the budgets are getting tighter and tighter?
Well, I think we're lucky that this particular festival has a great reputation and they like to come here, and I think they want to be part of keeping this alive. The thought that it might go away, I think, made people not happy. But the whole industry is changing dramatically, and of course the independent bookstores have been decimated, as well as publishing houses. So it's very hard, but people still need to have books in their lives. I don't know the answers. No. I honestly don't know. I'm happy that people have been really generous and think that the book fair is important to support literacy and literature. So we've been lucky in this way.
Yeah. Betty, I also wonder just about the, as this festival, as you mentioned, there are more and more authors that are really prominent here in Chicago, independent authors, but also authors that are getting book deals and being national. This is much more of a literary scene than it ever has been. Why do you think that is? Is Chicago, as an artist, as someone who has been involved in the arts and humanities here, is Chicago a literary town, and will it continue to be for the foreseeable future?
I think it is. I think Chicago is a much more important arts town than we give it credit. The theater situation alone here gives writers a platform that you don't find in many other places. So, you know, we have great institutions for people to study writing. And we have great literary tradition that I think is sort of, I don't know, maybe it's in that good Chicago water.
Betty Surfill is one of the members of the Near South Planning Board, and she, of course, is back to at the helm of the Printers Row Lit Fest, which happens June 8th, in Plymouth Court in the South Loop area in Printers Row. It's a must visit for any Chicagoan or for love of literature, and it's just a great summer festival. Betty, can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Hope to see everyone there, 8th and 9th.
There we go. I love that festival. That's one of my favorites. We've been trying for a while to get Betty on the show. We wanted to get her on for the download, and then we moved to the morning, and it's great to have her on at night. Betty Surf Hill, an artist, and also in charge of the Lit Fest, and maybe it is something in the water. All those pills and and goldfish and other pollutants that are put into water turns us into a great artistic and cultural town. That's how it usually works. Forget about the sixth and seventh toes and fingers. It also makes us very artistic, and that's good. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. There's no joy in Mudville tonight. The Chicago Bulls did the unthinkable, which instead of a miracle, they had a disaster, as they were. I don't understand the math here, but of course we're talking about the draft lottery, which just happened about 5 minutes ago, and the Chicago Bulls will pick 7th in the NBA draft, this after getting the 4th worst record. But because of the lottery picks, the Memphis Grizzlies and the New Orleans Pelicans and the Los Angeles Lakers, they all jumped ahead. And so the Bulls, whose best could have been 3rd, and I thought I read the worst could have been 6th, ended up 7th, where they picked last year Wendell Carter Sr. And to be fair, this draft is as exciting as it is a 3-player draft. After the 3rd player, and I'm not a sports radio guy. Pete Zimmerman might be more of bombastic in that regard. But all the talk has been about the top 3 players, and after that, it drops off a cliff. And the Bulls will be drafting 7th. This is a disappointing night for the Chicago Bulls organization.
Two words: Jarrett Culver.
Yeah. That's who you pick?
Texas Tech Red Raiders.
Oh, okay. And there he goes, a Texas Tech fan, the official college basketball team of the Extension 720. I don't understand. I guess I just don't understand the math, and people out there would explain it to me. But the Bulls dropped to the 7th overall, which is terrible. Very interesting, though, the New Orleans Pelicans got the number 1 pick. New Orleans, of course, the home of Anthony Davis, former Chicagoan, and he had been requesting a trade. There was thoughts of him going to the Los Angeles Lakers. We had Brandon B. Scoop Jackson in here not too long ago. He's an NBA writer, and he suggested on this program, you may have been listening, that Anthony Davis, a former Chicago product, he would not be surprised if Anthony Davis was packaged to a deal to Chicago, to the Chicago Bulls, that that's something he's heard and rumored from this summer. Obviously, the idea of playing with Zion Williamson in New Orleans might change his tune, but it also may change the New Orleans Pelicans' point of view, meaning we don't need Anthony Davis, we have Zion Williamson, so let's trade Anthony Davis. So, regardless, I'm not too happy, of course, as a Bulls fan, for the difficult season we had to endure as fans, where you watch the Bulls for the third straight season play uninspired basketball and almost in tank mode, but not tank enough. And here they are with the number 7 pick to show for it, which in basketball terms is mediocrity. Not great. Now, again, maybe the Bulls brass will be able to pull out something in 7, like you said, the kid from Texas Tech. But right now, the morale at the United Center needs to be, or is probably pretty low, based on the fact that they thought they had a chance at the number 1. And to see Horace Grant's face when they picked 7, he may have been nervous for real reasons, as Mark Harmon said, he looked nervous. All right, we'll take a break here. We'll come back, and at 8 o'clock, Professor Al Genie's in, and we'll talk about the his pick for the most important philosophy book of all time. We're going to do that and welcome him to Extension 720 coming up here right after the break and then the news. So stay with us.
Back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
It is Extension 720, and I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to go to Lincoln Square, talking to Mike Fouché about his neighborhood. We had a good conversation. Baker Miller, which was the bakery right there on Lincoln Avenue, which is near and dear to me because I knew it as a carpet store that I lived next to and above almost 25 years ago. Which is crazy to think about, but I go back to my old haunts. Talk with Mike about the emerging and changing neighborhood of Lincoln Square. We'll also talk with Benny Felsine and Caitlin Deaver about their great movie Booksmart, which will be coming out in theaters, limited release this weekend, and then a big release I think it's the next week, Memorial Day weekend, whatever it is, it's a summer blockbuster, and it's getting great reviews, and we'll talk with the two stars of that movie coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, it's been too long since my next guest has been in studio. I'm pleased to welcome our resident philosopher to the new Extension 720, Al Genie, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. He's also an avid student of the philosophies of the world. Is that a good way to say
that's
it?
That's correct word. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you. Good to see you.
Lovely new studios, lovely new home.
I have a lot of questions for you. A lot of personal questions for
all
you.
Right.
You're going to get to.
All right.
But I want to get into, it's safe to say that you have been spending your life in the pursuit of meaning.
Well, I've been spending my life reading wise individuals. I've learned recently, to my great discontent, that I am well learned, but I'm not necessarily a great thinker. Hmm. That is, I've learned a great deal. I've read a great deal, but I'm not a profound thinker. And yet I've tried to be a profound thinker my entire life and taught philosophy at one kind or another, at one level or another for the last 50
years. How did
you
learn that? What did you come to a conclusion at some point? You said, I'm just not that smart.
Do I make conclusions? Yes. Socrates is right. I know less than I know. And as I'm getting older, I forget more than I thought I knew every day. But I do think that I think philosophy is not simply a system or a series of answers. It's a pursuit. Hmm. And that's what's intriguing. It's a pursuit. It's the questions, not the answers always.
Yeah.
Heidegger said that. Heidegger's back in the news. And by the way, if you're interested in pursuing philosophy in any way right now and want to go at it another way, Hannah and Martin, which is playing at the Shattered Globe Theater right now, the relationship between Hannah Arendt and Martin Heidegger is fascinating. Fascinating in its attempt to say, he's saying, listen, you can't always answer the big questions, but if you're really to be a human, you have to ask the big questions.
Right. Well, the question you're always asked, and that's the premise of tonight's conversation, 312-981-7200 if you want to get in. But the question you're asked, as you study philosophy and you maybe you're not, what is it? You're not wise enough to think. You're not a thinker, but you're a student.
I'm a good communicator. I'm a communicator of philosophy.
People will
ultimately say, Al, I love philosophy. I've read a lot of great books. What do you think is the most important one? What's your favorite philosophy?
And you're not the first person. You're probably the 10,000th person who has. Well, you know, you're the resident philosopher here, there, or everywhere. Yeah, right. You've been around and you've got all these books. So what's the most important book you've ever read? What's the most interesting book you've ever read? You know, tell me. I just want that. And I, you know, for years I looked at people and I said, I can't do this. It's not possible to answer this question. So I would give them a list, a laundry list of books. I said, well, you have to start, of course, with Aristotle. You could do that in English, not necessarily in Latin or the Arabic from, or the Greek from which it's translated. And then you have to work your way up to St. Thomas. And don't forget, you have to go back to Socrates and Plato. And then we get into the Enlightenment. And then there's the Devotio Moderna. And then John Rawls comes along. And then their eyes glide over.
Where is it? You're in a coffee shop? And they're like, oh, I got to get my coffee.
I got to go. And I thought, I wisdom can't be taught and I can't communicate it. And then I realized that they're asking a very serious question that really can't be answered, but it can. I think rather than saying the most important philosophy book ever written, my answer is, what's the most important philosophy book that I've ever read? And that's Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Ooh, here we go.
Man's Search for Meaning. And it's a fascinating book about Viktor Frankl, an Austrian, MD, and then a PhD in philosophy, who was rounded up by the Nazis in World War II. And he and his family and his young bride, who was pregnant with a child, and his parents and his sister, were taken off to the various Auschwitz camps. And he spent over 3.5 years, and he lived through Auschwitz. And in this experience, he had to ask himself, he found out that the worst things in the world really can happen. Mm. That your worst imagination cannot comprehend and deal with the madness that he saw. That you cannot believe hundreds of thousands of people being exterminated every week, thousands of people every day. That the air is always a musky gray, and what it is ashes from the crematorium, et cetera, et cetera. He can't believe that I lived 4 or 3.5 years on less than 700 calories a day, a cup of gruel every day, and perhaps a potato or a little piece of bread. He can't believe that he had lost half of his body weight, yet did heavy manual labor day in and day out, often in the cold.
It's more than the human mind can
comprehend. And more than the body should be able to learn. He says one of the lessons he learned at the camp is that he found out, and he was a doctor, that all the medical community was wrong. The human body could cope with more torture, more pain, more cold, more sleep deprivation, and more starvation than any medical books have ever even suggested as the outside possibility. And through this all, he realized there were certain basic things here. He's being tormented by this. He's lost everything in these camps. And these camps brought out the worst in people and the worst that ever could happen to people. And yet, in that, he had to decide to live or die. Because it was easy to die. And he talks about some of the people who gave up. He called them Muslims. He didn't mean Muslims in that sense. He called them Muslims that they simply caved in. And that was a term that they created. They had no connection to an Arab tradition. And they stopped eating. They stopped standing up. They stopped shaving. They limped, and therefore they were selected and gone, or often would give their bread away the night before because they knew that they couldn't take it anymore.
They couldn't take it anymore, so they wanted to stand out to
be taken
away.
To die. They wanted to say, because it was easier to die. Suicide was a huge problem in the camps. In fact, the guards would shoot you if you didn't try to stop a suicide, because they'd run into the electric wires, because that was a quicker way to die than perhaps other things. And he said, in all this, throughout this whole time, that what we had to do is, I found out that what we were looking for in all this, when everything was stripped away from us, when even as Jews or Christians, you had to ask, if there is a God, why would he permit this?
Right.
That what we were actually doing was trying to locate meaning. That being in these camps, that the basic philosophical question is, what is the meaning of my life, or what meaning can I find in life?
Al Gini is here, our resident philosopher, and he's also a business ethics professor at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. We're talking about the book Man's Search for Meaning. This is Viktor Frankl's book, which we'll get into how he came about with this book, but obviously as we hear the story of this, you can understand why this may be, as you say, the most important book in
philosophy. Right, this is not Socrates sitting on the, on the veranda in
front of
Parthenon and suggesting, well, let's debate issues.
Right.
This is a man under de-stress 24/7.
Al, let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back because I think, you know, at the beginning of the show, I talked about the difference between book smart and street smart.
Mm.
And this almost fits into the way that you do have Socrates sitting on a very book smart, talking, having the luxury to debate the higher meanings of our purpose,
right,
where you have Viktor Frankl, who doesn't have that luxury in the moment
and
on
must
the street.
Choose every second to stay alive.
Al Genie, my guest on Extension 720, 312-981-7200 if you want to get in. We'll take a break. Come back. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. We are talking about philosophy with our resident philosopher, Professor Al Genie, who for years has been asked the question, what's the most important book in philosophy? And there are many people who will argue about what school of thought and what debate and what philosopher in whatever time was the most influential or the wisest.
Yeah.
But you call out a point in this when we're talking about Man's Search for Meaning, which is written by Viktor Frankl, which may not be a household name when it comes
to
philosophers.
He's not now, but he was for my generation.
Yeah. But millions and millions of copies.
14 million copies sold, in excess of 14 million copies sold. And in reality, he's translated in every language, and he lived to 92 years of age. In fact, I have a personal story. In 1969, I was a rookie professor at Loyola University, and Loyola University celebrated its 100th anniversary. And for that, we brought in scholars from all over the world, including Hannah Arendt, who I got drunk with and smoked cigarettes with, Foucault, Conrad Lorenz, and Viktor Frankl. And I was sent to the airport to pick him up, and I kept looking for this tall, kind of slump-shouldered Jewish fella coming off the plane looking haggard and tired. No such person gets off. So I go to the white phone in those days, and Frank, would you come to the white phone? And this short, 5'8", beautifully coiffed, first manicured fingernails I'd ever seen on a man, in a perfect suit with a young Fräulein, said, Frankl here, good to meet you. And I said, Professor Frankl, I read all your books. He says, and I thought they were really wonderful. Yes, they are very good. Good. Let us go. I would like to go to a nightclub.
Now.
Now. And it was 8:30 at night, and we went to Mr. Kelly's.
Oh, there you go.
And I stayed at Mr. Kelly's most of the evening, and I thought, this can't be Viktor Frankl. He danced. He was having a wonderful time. He was really drinking. And the next day, he got up and talked.
Yeah.
And the room was in tears. And somewhere along the line, he just pulled up his shirt. And there were a series of numbers, and I have them right here. 119-104. And he said, these I never forget, and these I'll never be able to overcome. But it was the worst in my life. But it's given me something to give to life. Mm. My meaning is to share the fact that the desperate pursuit of every human being in any condition is to find some meaning in life.
It really is a great question to debate, because when you think about the philosophers that are idolized in academia, you think of, like we mentioned, the Socrates or the Aristotle, but this concept of them in flowing robes, sitting on rocks, and having a conversation about
conversation,
life.
Right.
Please pass the grapes.
Yeah,
right, that kind of thing.
Right.
But to recognize that to find meaning, you need to be in moments where that meaning is questioned, or that meaning is
lived.
Pressed.
Lived. And I think that you make a wonderful distinction, even referring to this play. Heidegger became this genius, is now recognized still as a metaphysical genius, but he was so lost in the clouds, he didn't realize that Germany was being surrounded by Nazis, and he caved into the Nazis because he didn't want to stop thinking. And because he didn't want to stop thinking, he, you know, was co-opted by the Nazis and abused by the Nazis, so on and so forth, and almost lost his place in the university system because of it. And Hannah Arendt, his former student, helped to save him. But he was so lost in speculative thought, he wasn't sure of anything else in life. And I think philosophy should not be how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. By the way, the answer is 9, 11 if two of them are anorexic. But anyway, it should not be, you know, what is the sound of water at night? It should not be, do things exist when I am not around them? That's speculative harmonics. I think they may be true at a certain level of logic, et cetera, to clarify thinking. But I think Socrates is right. The essential question of life is, how do I live well with others? How do I have dignity in in life? Mm-hmm. How do I live this life without damaging others? And Socrates always says, I'm not interested in cosmology. I don't care about, you know, ellipses. I don't care about nature. In some sense, he overdid that. But he says, I care about how do we as human beings interact and what are our obligations to others? So I think when philosophy loses itself in speculative harmonics,
yeah.
it deserves the criticisms it gets. But this is a man who blended both his degree in medicine and then psychiatry and then a PhD in philosophy and said, what is the purpose of life? And he wound up saying, you know, the camps, these horrible experiences, you know, where they lost everything, where the pain was excruciating, where there was constant death, where constant trial and error, forced people to make decisions about life. That, you know, we often think of many of the Jewish inmates there, and I can't imagine it. I've studied it, the Holocaust, so much, it's numbing to me. But they had to make a decision to stay alive, so they weren't just robots after a while. They may have been robots getting on that train, not knowing what's going on, because they couldn't believe that other human beings would do this to them.
That seems to be a big through line, too, is just about belief or what the boundaries are of what you can
yeah.
fathom, what you can accept, what your brain can accept is the limit. And that seems to be almost at the crux when it talks about the philosophy of Frankl's talking
yeah.
about this concept of what we know versus what's reality.
Yeah. And I think he develops a psychiatric formula called logotherapy, and logo in Greek means meaning, mind, or meaning, excuse me. And so he's trying to find the meaning therapy. What do we need in life? What direct the force? Now, there's a danger in this because you could get the wrong meaning. We know that, you know, many of these white supremacists are fanatically driven to this. Some of these shooters in recent history, and by the way, 46, 45 school shootings since the beginning of the year, this awful thing. Some of these people doing it for random acts of violence, some doing it for psychotic reasons, some doing it because they believe that this is a good thing to do. They have meaning in that. They're,
right.
you know, and there's a danger in false meaning as well. And I think Frankl's talking about meaning that surrounds you with, in the Socratic question, of meaning that gives you the ability to live well with others.
Well, that's the great point.
Yeah.
Live well with others that you're talking about, because you're right. It's hard to say that the horrific acts of someone who decides to do a mass shooting.
Yeah.
isn't steeped in their own search for meaning or their own
yeah,
belief
it is.
Structure.
They're
doing the same thing. They're just misguided.
But it's misdirected and it's malevolent in a very real sense. And so I think that what he's trying to blend here is the psychology of life, an ethics of life, and a respect for human dignity. And what he suggests, you know, is very clear. Besides, he said he learned four things in his camp. The first thing I pointed mm-hmm. out to you was that the human body could take more suffering than he never thought possible. Secondly, even in the face of senseless, arbitrary cruelty, we have a nagging need to find meaning in our lives. To live is to suffer, whether you're suffering with a sick child, whether you're suffering from a disease, whether you're suffering from poverty, whether you're suffering from lack of love, even in that, we seek to survive by finding some meaning in that suffering. I must tell you, I've had some physical illnesses lately, and my only comfort is, I'm serious about this, I wish it made me feel much, much better, but people are suffering more than I am. Okay. And there's comfort in that. You know, I think we get lost in the solipsism of self. And we forget we're not the only kid on the block, right? My grandmother used to say, you complain about not having new shoes, and there's a guy over there without feet.
Yeah.
Boom, right?
Boom, right.
And the third thing you talked about, that forces beyond our control could take away everything we possess except one thing, the ultimate human freedom to decide how we face our fate, to decide how we do it. And maybe the best example of this is the dignity with which both perhaps horrible people facing execution, formal execution, go to their death. The dignity with some of our great heroes, you know, I have we're used to be in a building where it said, I have but one life to give to my country, right?
Right.
You know, Patrick Henry. But to find meaning even in that madness is, and finally, and we could talk about this a little bit, and this is not a promo for my book, that humor sustained him. Little pieces of humor. That is, holy, some part of humanity has to laugh. And when you can't laugh, you dry up.
Professor Al Genie in studio tonight, our resident philosopher, talking about the search for meaning and man's search for meaning, Viktor Frankl's book about the most important piece of philosophy out there, as he's been asked that question several times by students and others in coffee shops, and then Al's answer is really, really long, and their latte gets cold. Professor Al Genie, my guest here in Extension 720, 312-981-7200. If you want to join the conversation, do so. We'll get to all that right after the news, so stay with us.
So, you're a philosopher?
Yes. 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 I think very deeply. I think very deeply. I think very deeply.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Coffin, Al Genie, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. Also, our resident philosopher is here tonight. He's also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Tonight, the theme is by the book.
Yeah.
You know, and I love that you're here to talk about this, and it kind of works out because it really, we're kind of parsing out this idea of the difference between book smart and street smart.
Right.
But this difference, and can you live?
And we can even make a distinction in the book. First of all, he wrote the book 9 days after he left camp.
And we're talking about Frankl's book.
Frankl's book's importance. Man's Search for Meaning. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is a gentleman who was 92 years old when he died in a different era. Man is the Latin concept of mankind. So it's not specific, gender specific, but of course it'd be how people should do it. Anyway, he wrote the actual, his experiences down in 9 days after he left camp, hung on to them a while, and it was published, I think, in 49, called The Existential Philosopher's Trials or something like that. I've forgotten the name right this second. And then later, in the 50s, it was picked up, and the second part of the book was his theory of logotherapy, which he developed out of his experience in the camp. So what I'm suggesting to you, ladies and gentlemen, don't read the second part. You'll get lost in the particulars of the philosophy and the psychology of it all. And if you're not a clinical therapist, it may not be worth your while. But the first part is his diary, his memoir, rather than a diary, his memoir of his experiences from the time he and his family were arrested and sent off on a train to the concentration camps. So in a very real sense, Frankl was two things. Frankl was a real theoretician and a practitioner.
And there's something about him being a messenger when it comes to the idea of a search for meaning.
Yeah.
That you trust the messenger because he was faced with life and
that's
death.
Right. He's not talking about, again, how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. I don't know, six, seven. Who's going to beat me on that, right? But he could say, the reality is, Nietzsche is right. And by the way, Nietzsche was not a funny fellow. Nietzsche was kind of a strange philosopher. Nietzsche gets more creds in philosophical circles than I really think he deserves. But Nietzsche said something, one line is worth his entire memory. That which does not kill me makes me stronger. Mm. That which does not kill me, Frankl would translate to, that which does not kill me teaches me something to make me stronger.
And it is interesting because Frankl was able to really search for meaning and decipher the concept of life and death and bounce that off of old philosophies that he had studied and you know, whether it be Nietzsche, whether it be Socrates or whatever, and be able to, in the moment, have a say, hey, yes or no.
This works. This works. That doesn't work. This is a real guide. I had the experience of rereading Day of the Rose, the famous book, and there was a disputation going on. Did Aristotle allow laughter? And did Jesus really own his own clothes if he was divine? Oh, give me a break. They get lost in the minutiae. They got lost in the minutiae of the text rather than wondering what it was about. And I think for Frankl, he made it alive. He made it real by saying, I lived through this. I found meaning. I had to find meaning to continue. I wanted to live not for me. I wanted to live to see my wife again. He assumed his parents were dead because they were older in the selection process. Although his wife was pregnant, she wasn't showing. And he was hoping she was alive. She was not, as it turned out. But he clung to his image of his wife. He clung to this love of his life, of his wife. And he said, the salvation for me was knowing that I loved her and I held her as my beloved. And I wanted the chance to see her again. And one dreary winter day, the second year into the concentration camps, he was suffering from dysentery and everything else and didn't know if he was going to be selected that day because he looked wan and he looked weak. Mm. And he said to his friend Otto, and if I may quote him, "Listen, Otto, if I don't get back home to my wife, you should see her again, then tell her, I'm going to cry, tell her I talked of her daily. Secondly, that I loved her more than anything or anyone. Thirdly, the short time we have been married to each other has outweighed everything, even the horror that I have gone through."
The search for meaning in life only can happen, I mean, it can happen in different ways, but it seems in what you're saying, the search for meaning can happen when that life flashes before your eyes.
It sometimes does. I mean, the gallows wisdom is sometimes very acute, but very short-lived, mm-hmm. Obviously. But I do think that I've seen people really unhappy who, and when I really push them, I mean, I've lived long enough to be with friends and known them for 30, 40 years, and one of the continuous issues is they're unhappy, and they're not. I don't mean, in America, we think of happiness as, you know, do I have enough money? Are my kids going to the right schools? Am I my career going well? They lacked a purpose. That their life was full but purposeless, and to me, I translate it as meaningless. All right, they did their job. They paid their bills, but there was nothing beyond that. And one of the real critiques, and Heidegger did talk about this, that because we forget that there is a larger issue, there are larger parameters, there are larger goals in life than just living, we get caught in the minutiae of living. And that's not meaning, that's busyness.
Yeah, right. We talked about that. That's been something we've talked about in this program. 312s and 773s, both... They make a good point that, you know, 217 says, "My uncle gave Frankl's book to me about 30 years ago."
Yeah.
A great read. It was a household name, 312 says, to anyone who went to college my time. Read it 40 years ago. I agree, and all that you're talking about. But I guess the question, and there may be, if you're in philosophy, if you are a philosophy student and you're pushing forward, you're going to know the name Frankl. But for a generation that may be...
A generation of non-readers
or just not focused on philosophy in that way, or the way that colleges used to be focused on it.
Yeah.
They have no idea.
They have no idea. And I think it used to be taught in psychology courses. There are two books that I've taught over 50 years in which students have come to me, rather ask me, what's your favorite book? He says, I only remember two books in college, and you taught them. Abraham Maslow's Man's Search for Meaning, which we were talking about during the break, and maybe we'll do that next time. We'll think about that. Secondly, Viktor Frankl's book, because they weren't just technical, logical doctrines that you had to parse and figure out. And what does this mean? Is this a double negative? And how does this work out? Rather, they were life driven, and the very purpose of it was to find some purpose in your life that keeps you going. Why are you here? Why are we getting an education? One of my real laments. I'm in the School of Business, but it's not that, and I'm not critiquing that, is that too often now people go to college for a job. And I think you go to university to get a job, that's all right. But there's got to be more to it than that.
Right.
Because I always say that a business person is a vocation. A business person should have value. A business person should have a goal. A business person should have ethics. It isn't just making money. And I think Frankl is saying that you have to find something in life larger than the pain, the normality, or the given pleasures. We have to find something larger that we could call purposeful.
And it really is about, as he, in the book, and he talks about this, you get to this point where meaning is all you can take out of it.
Right.
That's the search.
That's all.
And maybe he's never going to get to the end of it, but it's that search. It's that want to figure out what's happening that pushes you forward.
Right. And I'll quote another philosopher. Jean-Paul Sartre said, and I thought at the time, the first time I read it, it was totally absurd, that even if they're tying you to the stake and gagging you and blindfolding you, you still have the freedom and the meaning left in your life to yell in the back of your brain, no to you. Well, that's kind of desperate meaning. But I think Frankl's talking about another kind of meaning. In the end, I think the meaning of an individual's life is to help other people find their meaning and to be meaningful with others. And Frankl is really talking about parochial meaning, not transcendental meaning. Although, of course, religion can be the meaning and directive force in one's life. But he says you have to translate religion. My grandmother used to always say, I love my grandmother. I miss my grandmother immensely. It was just Mother's Day. And, you know, and this is all in English. She would say it in Italian. I hate the people who go to church all the time, go to communion, stick out their tongues. We were Catholic Italians, of course. Stick out their tongues, so on and so forth. Then during the week, they kill people. What was that religion about? You know? And Franco's talking about religion.
Yeah.
Should be a directive force in your life to others, not, you know, just one has to be a in the Presbyterian Church because one is a business person, yeah, after all.
Al, always good to see you, man. It's been too long, and, you know, I hope you feel better.
I do feel
so
better.
So where are you at in your recovery? You had back surgery.
I'm
where
in week
at?
Eight.
In week eight.
Yes, and I want to help the general audience, and I've had a number of back surgeries. I think I found the reason for it. It's called age. So, ladies and gentlemen, do yourself a favor. Do not get old, and you'll be fine. Hey, bad things happen even to good people. I just got a bad piece of luck here. I'm going to be fine. But
I will say this, and I hope that this means something to you from me and to, I think, the audience listening, is it is a joy to have you here. These are questions that I don't think get asked enough and answers that aren't searched for enough. And it is a pleasure, even though you are in misery, you, of course, bring the energy and the excitement for the show. And I can't thank you enough for coming down to the studio at night here. And then I think earlier you were telling me in the break, you're like, yeah, I saw someone on the L on the way in. I'm like, what are you taking the L? You ain't got a black car or something like that that you can...
Well, I was hoping you were to send one, but apparently it's not in the budget.
Oh, jeez.
But thank you for being here.
I really appreciate it.
It's wonderful being here together. And the radio audience has noticed this. We've actually been radio buddies for about 25 years, and I'm glad it's still going.
And there's a reason it's still going, because you continue to...
Because you're desperate and you have nothing else to do.
No, you continue to bring meaning and to push and to try to talk about things that aren't usually talked about. Al Genie, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He is also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Our resident philosopher, we'll see you later this summer. Thanks, Al.
Take care.
Extension 720 rolls along tonight. 312-981-7200. Man, Pete, it's always great to have Professor Genie here. I mean, I'm not kidding. That is dedication. He puts it on the books. He's like, hey, I've got a little back surgery to deal with, but I'll be there, cane and all. He's not lying. We've worked together a long time. I remember I met Al when I worked on a show called Metropolis, which was a Saturday afternoon show with Aaron Freeman over at WBEZ, and that was the first show I worked on full-time, which was I think it was 12 to 4 or something like that. And Al would come on, and he would talk philosophy with Aaron, and I was the producer. And I was always impressed with the energy that he would bring to prove his points and talk about these issues. And 25 years later, still something in our media that doesn't get talked about a lot. And I don't think it needs to. I don't think that you need to make it breaking news or make it a philosophy beat. But I do think these are questions that as we move along and new generations, you know, become those who are the power of their minds, become, you know, their thought is the mainstream thought, that they should be talking about these things. About what is a search for meaning? What is a search? What is the meaning of life in that search? And I think it plays so well into our topic tonight, just our theme overall, as we talked about, which is a little less than life and death, but we're talking about book smart versus street smart. And in the philosophy world, can you really discern the meaning of life if you have not lived it? And when you're talking about someone in a concentration camp who is facing death in the face, it becomes absurd to think that they're going to have a debate about it. They're just going to explore what the meaning of life is in that moment, the moment where it means the most. I just think that that's pretty well said, and I think that, and I also, it's hilarious to think, because, you know, I get a lot of texters who text in who are like, this is a household book. I mean, you know, they could pick up from me that I'm not familiar with Frankl's work. I think at the beginning of the interview I was saying Frankl. You know, I didn't put the German Unk on there. And it's true. The only thing I remember about my philosophy class in college is that my philosophy teacher was searching for the meaning of why he had to be there. did not feel at all like he really gave any in. Like it was a very laid back class. And I don't know about you, Pete. Were you taking philosophy?
Yeah, we had to take nine hours, I think.
Oof.
And I don't remember
any of it.
No, I really don't.
I've thought about this. I was going to bring it up with Al, but I didn't want to sidetrack. When I was at Second City and going through the conservatory in Second City, this would have been like mid to late 90s, I had a teacher, Frances Callier, who I just saw in Wine Country. She was in the movie Wine Country, which is on Netflix, but she was one of our teachers. And I remember they were teaching us how to prepare for improv. When you play short form games in improv, you need to be ready. And one of the games was, she was talking about different styles and different genres and different period pieces, and you need to be up to speed. So if an audience member calls out Nietzsche, you need to know what that means. You can't be on stage acting like you don't know.
Right, Packers linebacker.
Right. Exactly. So you need to be prepared. So I remember going to the bookstore, I have a purpose for this Second City improv. I'm gonna figure it out. So I went to the part of the Borders bookstore on Michigan Avenue that had philosophy, and just grabbed the 101s on everybody. Like six books, and I went home and I read them. I didn't really read them. I didn't retain any of it. But for like maybe 2 months, I never got a chance to use it.
You're
on
waiting
stage.
For somebody to,
and I was talking to friends,
out.
Going, you know, the thing about life, you know, and we talk about death and darkness, and they're just like, I just took the class because I read five books for an improv game I never got to play. That's what the only philosophy training I had. And then Al, for 20 years, talking to Al about, and rarely do we ever talk specifically about one philosopher. There's not too many times that we've sat down and talked about one book. There'll be bigger issues like humor or work. We did the Seven Deadly Sins show. Mm-hmm. Things like that where you philosophy obviously plays a big part in it, but it's not necessarily about the study of that philosophy. So that was fun tonight to do. And I think it plays right into this idea of, you know, the search. What philosophy do you subscribe to? The one that is sitting on the rock with the flowing robe saying, you know, before I finish this wine, let me think about the world we live in, or the person who is facing life and death in front of them. And that's a question, you know, and I think there's probably merits to both. And really it's about finding balance in who you subscribe to or what philosophy you subscribe to. So anyway, we move on from philosophy and we move to movies. Coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever. Beanie's a huge star. She was in Lady Bird. And continues to have success. I just saw her in something else I was going to tell you about. I think it was on Netflix. It was one of the shows that she was in. I was like, oh, I got to tell Pete that I just saw her. Anyway, they're up. They're the stars of the new movie Booksmart, which is out, coming up limited this weekend. They're doing a bunch of screenings for college kids, things like that. And then it's going to be out Memorial Day. We'll have that conversation coming up here on Extension 720. So stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film Booksmart is out in theaters this week. It's a story of two overachieving high school girls who wait till their last night to, well, party.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges.
I'm incredible at but I also got a 1560 on the SATs.
We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
He broke art rules.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
Susan
one.
Susan B. Anthony.
Damn it.
The film follows in the footsteps of some of the great high school party films of all time. Fast Times, 16 Candles, Can't Hardly Wait, or Superbad. But for all the high school characters and awkward party and sex scenes, this film is ultimately about friendship. The comedy is directed by Olivia Wilde and stars Jason Sudeikis, Jessica Williams, Will Forte, Lisa Kudrow. But the real stars are the two young women who play Molly and Amy, Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever. The two are in studio right now on Extension 720. Thanks for being here. Great film.
Oh, thank you so much.
How did you get involved in this? What drew you to this script?
Caitlin, I feel like you should start.
Yeah, there was I got the script about 4 years ago, actually, and it had been Booksmart had existed since 2009. I fell in love with it immediately. I think for being a young woman, this opportunity doesn't come around too often because I feel like there's been a misconception about women being funny, and so we're never given this opportunity. And that's the thing that struck me first. And then 2 years later, Olivia was attached to direct it, and I'm like, oh my God. What a better, I mean, it was just like so great. And then she knew immediately that she wanted to hire Beanie. And then here she is.
I had read the script like 3 years ago, and reading initially for a character that no longer exists in the film even. And I was so taken with the concept, and the film was giving space for two women that were best friends to be that smart, that engaged, that brilliant, and so funny. And I knew I wanted to be a part of it in any way I could. And then when Olivia came on, we had lunch, and she was like, first of all, I was like, I'm having lunch with Olivia Wilde. This is insane. And she was like, I want you to play Molly. And I was so honored, and I knew that Caitlin was attached, and I'm such a fan of hers. I think you're one of the most exceptional actors. So I was so excited, genuinely so excited to get to collaborate with her. But it was a no-brainer, I think, for both of us. You read those characters and how much fun they get to have, and mm-hmm. how fresh and multidimensional all of the characters in the film are, and then Olivia Wilde directing it.
Yeah, and you know, there's something really great about, obviously, the characters and the backdrop being high school, and it is a fresh take on some of the characters that we almost become caricatures when it comes to the high school party film. But in this case, this film, as I said at the beginning, is really about your friendship. Did you feel that from the script? Was that something where you're like, this is really less about a party comedy, if you will, yeah. and more about the two of you?
Yeah. I mean, that was always the story. It was their beautiful friendship. But I think Olivia did want to make it about the ensemble at the end of the day. But it is such a beautiful story about these two girls who just love each other so much. So I definitely knew that's always there. And Katie Silverman, our writer, is an incredible genius woman. I mean, I've never met someone as smart as her. She is a genius. And everything was so on page and so clear for us. Day one, yeah, really.
I think once the four of us realized that ultimately Booksmart is so funny and it's so real and it's so crazy, but it's also kind of a breakup movie. It's about how two best mm-hmm. friends have to part because high school is ending. And I think that's so relatable. I mean, most of us go to high school and most of us have those really, really deep friendships at that time. And so it is really a relationship movie, but there's so much fun in it. But it's truly about the genuine connection these two girls have.
And the emotion, because there's something about the chemistry that you have both on screen that draws you in and really makes it's emotional when you go through the breakup.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how do you, as actors, how do you do that? As not necessarily best friends from high school, how do you portray that?
You know, I always think that the best comedies have a lot of heart to them. And I think Booksmart is exactly that. It will make you laugh until you pee your pants, and then it'll make you cry. I think that's what's so powerful about friendships, is that that fight is so heartbreaking. It almost feels worse than a fight with a romantic partner. So, I mean, we didn't, for our fight, specifically me and Beanie, we didn't talk. Yes. We haven't had a fight yet.
We haven't gone there yet.
But we didn't talk the whole day.
It was one of those rare days, because basically we're together on screen the entire film, which was so fun. But this was like literally, I think, one of the 2 days that we had different start times in the morning, or in the evening, actually, because we shot most of the movie all night. So Caitlin was in first, and we lived together while we were shooting the film, prepping, rehearsing, and then shooting the film. So she left in earlier than I did, and we didn't speak. We weren't able to see or speak to each other that whole day. And the fight was the only scene that we didn't run together, rehearse together, before we actually filmed it, because we knew there'd be this sort of raw quality to it if we kind of just had never heard each other say the line.
And Olivia had told us that she wanted to try and attempt to get it done in one take, and that if we couldn't, she would obviously set it up differently, but we got it done in one take.
Yeah.
We did the scene that's in the film is the second take we did, and then we did four takes of it, but really we got it on the second
take. It's very rare to have a scene between two people in one shot, and it's such a raw part of the film that I think makes the humor land even better, because you're actually invested mm-hmm. in these girls. You're really genuinely invested in them. And so that can sort of take you to a super comedic space or a super like emotional space.
For both of you being in that situation where you were running it and you weren't rehearsing it beforehand, There is a rawness to it. The approach to that as actresses, as people who really want to capture that emotion, how do you go about that? Are you nervous about it, the fact that you guys have become so close, that you and the characters in this film are funny and they're continually lovey? Yeah. Or is it just script and you're like, okay, no, I'm going to do some...
No, I think because we had gotten so close, I was less concerned about getting there emotionally.
Yeah.
I feel like when you have a deeper connection with someone, it's easier to act genuinely be upset. So like when we shot the scene, I was genuinely sad.
Yeah.
I was crying.
I think also we had the benefit of actually doing what the girls in the film are doing, which is that we were fighting for the first time. We were seeing what the other person like looked like, sounded right. like, felt like in those emotions, which neither of us as Caitlin and Beanie had ever experienced, but neither of Molly and Amy, this is their first fight. And so I think what Olivia does cinematically with dropping out our dialogue. So halfway through the fight scene, you stop hearing what the girls are saying and you just see them screaming at each other. And Olivia always talked to us about how when you're fighting, sometimes you don't even know what you're saying, but you're committing to it so hard because you're like in that space of fighting and you can't catch your emotions. And I think that's so humanly captured in the film, and we both love that scene so much. And it was really scary to shoot in front of a lot of background actors and the rest of our cast, and it felt very vulnerable.
The movie Booksmart is out this week. In studio tonight on Extension 720, Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Deaver. What we'll do, we'll take a quick break, we'll come back, continue the conversation here about the movie Booksmart. Stay with us.
Amazing.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio, Beanie Feldstein,
and
Caitlin Deaver. They are the stars of Booksmart, which is out this week. Great film that really follows in the footsteps in the tradition of the high school party film. Are you familiar with how much pressure is it on you as actresses to be a part of that genre? That genre that I mentioned at the top of this interview, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, 16 Candles, Can't Hardly Wait, It's Super Bad. Those films have become almost centerpieces for generations. Mm-hmm. Do you see it that way?
Well, I don't think we always talk about this. You never go into a film with any expectations. You only go into a film with passion and a commitment to the story and a love of the people that you're about to work with. And that's kind of all you can ever know for certain is how much you love the story and how hard you're working on it. But Olivia actually screened Fast Times at Ridgemont High for the whole cast and the creative team and some of the crew before a day or two before we started filming. We knew that that was the spirit of the film that we wanted to make, and the, you know, Breakfast Club, and there's so many more. But you never know until it's all... Filmmaking is such a collaborative effort, so you can only bring your passion and your artistry to your section of it. But when I watch it, I'm just so proud of it, because it's anthemic. It really is. And
That's a great word. That's exactly what it is.
Those movies are generational anthems, and to think that Booksmart could speak to this generation so greatly is it really means a lot. You know, it reminds me of why I wanted to be an actor in the first place. It's just really such an honor, because we put so much hard work. I mean, it was such a team effort on the movie. I just feel, I didn't even think about that, though. We didn't really think about that going into it. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those films are about either two guys or a girl that's looking for a guy. And what we love about Booksmart is it's about two girls that are really self-assured and really secure in who they are. And it's just about them expanding themselves. It's not about reforming themselves or chasing after someone else. So it's really a celebration of female friendship within that genre, which I feel like is a whole new take.
And it's a project, too, that's helmed by a woman, that's written by women. This is a project that, when you really are looking at the specific genre of the high school party film, there really hasn't been an experience like that.
Yeah.
Usually, like you said, if the movie will be about the boys in the high school. But this is something that is authentic and comes from that space. What makes it different? What makes it a funnier movie or a different movie because of that?
Well, there's such a positivity to the way the girls relate to each other.
Yeah.
And I think, at least in our friendship specifically, but also just in our female friendships, that is really truthful to female friendships. It's like a celebration
of each other.
They're cheerleaders for each other. Like, they're number one cheerleaders. And so that... that spirit of positivity and also intellect. Like, all the humor between Molly and Amy comes from how brilliant they are. Mm-hmm. More brilliant than I am. Like, I was like, this dialogue is genius. And that's all credit to Katie Silverman and Olivia, because they just knew how these girls would relate to each other. But comedy coming from brightness, or comedy coming from academic intellect, is very new to this genre, I think. And it's celebrated with such fun and silliness. Yeah. And you get to see smart girls be really bright and then also be really crazy and really loose. And I feel like there's a multidimensionality to every character in the film, not just our characters. Right. It's such an ensemble cast.
Yeah, there's something really great about the film in the way that it starts with caricatures that you feel like, I've seen that character before. And by the end of it, they've unraveled the character. You have, and that goes for both of your characters, but also the cast, the ensemble behind, that there may be moments where you recognize, or there's some sort of twist that takes you as the viewer out of the character you thought you were viewing.
Yeah, well,
how important is that for a film and for you as actors to portray when you know that you're a step ahead of the audience?
I think it's really important. I think that's one of the greatest messages in Booksmart, is that we are asking the audience to maybe look at the world a little differently and maybe judge people a little less. And I think that's a beautiful thing about Booksmart.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think the brilliance of it is that it uses what the audience is going to project on these kids to its advantage. So it's saying, oh, you think we're just the smart girls? Just you wait. Oh, you think AAA is just the hot girl? Or you think Jared is just the rich boy? Just you wait. These characters have so much more than meets the eye. And specifically through my character, Molly, she's placing a lot of those judgments on them as well, because she isn't willing to get to know them. She's just clutching Amy and saying, this is all I need. But throughout the film, she really gets to know a lot of her classmates. And Amy's always been a bit more open, which is her kind of brilliance in the film. But together, they open themselves up to actually getting to know these people that they've gone to high school with for four years.
And I think that's why people are relating to the film so much already, is because we're all sort of guilty of judging people.
And ourselves.
For both of you, well, how do you relate to this film? You obviously, as you mentioned, everyone goes to high school. So, but for you to be closer to the age of that these characters are portrayed, how do you relate?
Well, I feel like both of these girls know themselves pretty well. It's not a movie about these two young women finding themselves necessarily. I mean, that movie is great, but it's not what Booksmart is. And that's the one thing I really love about it, is that they aren't ashamed of being smart, and they know that they are fun, and they just want to prove it to other people. But I guess what I related to most is just like the anxieties and fear that come with being young and taking that step with your like biggest crush in high school. There's this one beautiful moment where my character jumps into this pool with this girl she has a crush on at school. And it is just like the way Olivia filmed it. It is just, and the music, and
it's shot so well.
It's cinematically like, it looks like an art. Every shot in this film looks like an art piece, but it just, that moment just makes me think of, oh my God, that is exactly what it feels like to have a crush and to finally have that moment where you're like, okay, this is my chance.
Yeah. I don't know. I just thought about this, but I feel like I was much like Molly in high school, in that I was very like black or white, this or that. And then when you choose a side, you kind of double down and you're like, well, this is how I guess I feel all the time, always, and never really left any room for like a gray area or like the multidimensionality of people or complex kind of opinion on something. And so I think the lesson that Molly learns throughout the film is really to open herself up to seeing people for who they fully are, and that you don't always have to double down or be so stubborn. And so I really relate to that journey. And I think it was one that I went on from like 17, 18, 19, where you're like, I don't have to, my opinions can change. My concepts of people can grow. I'm going to grow myself. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that our characters are so smart, but they're not always wise. And it gives people room to feel like, oh, I'm a little bit flawed, but also I'm a really great person. And there's just a lot of love in the movie, and I'm someone that likes comedy that builds people up, and I think our film is really a testament to that.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of seeing the film with a bunch of kids at Columbia College. And
it's incredible.
And yeah, usually we'll see, the experience is one that is much different when you're screening a film for an interview. you go into a room with a couple of critics and everyone's quiet. Everyone sits there and then you walk out and you're like, I don't know if that was good. I don't know. I have no idea. You're just your brain. Every movie I see, I'm like, that's great. Watching this film with a bunch of young adults who have just had that experience, and to watch them respond to the different jokes and the different, not even the jokes, but the scenes, the moments in the film. It's for you to be in that room at the same time and to watch the audiences react like that, especially audiences that young. How does it make you feel?
I was so moved.
We were able to, we've only seen the movie twice, and we hadn't seen the ending credits yet. And we walked in, and seeing everyone's faces at the end is just like, what a moving experience. I don't even know what to feel right now. I literally just like, I'm overjoyed.
It's just so exciting. You make a film and you're like, oh, I mean, we think it resonates this way, or we think that this message is in it. And every screening we've gone to and every person we've talked to, they're getting it. And that's
they
like
understand it to a level
ask.
That, yeah, it's great.
They're just having so much fun. They're getting it. Their questions were so insightful. It was just, and they had so much fun, it seemed. It was really special.
Well, the film is called Booksmart. It's out in theaters this week. It stars Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever, my guests tonight on Extension 720. I can't thank you enough for coming in, and congrats on the film.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Don. Yes, like you said, it is Justin here. It is Extension 720, and it is 720 WGN. Is there anything better than Chicago in springtime? You could take a stroll down Michigan Avenue, hit the lakefront, or if you really want to see how beautiful Chicago is, hit up the neighborhoods. Tonight, we continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods. Last week, it was Woodlawn. Before that, Little Village. Tonight, let's go north to Lincoln Square. I love Lincoln Square. I have fond memories of living at the corner of Lincoln Avenue and Leland back in 1995. Oh my gosh, I'm dating myself. Lincoln Square is on the northwest side, the heart of it, right on Lincoln Avenue between Montrose and Lawrence. Historically, it was the home of Chicago's German population. But today, beyond street festivals, you'd be hard-pressed to find that community. Sure, a couple of bars and restaurants stand, but the Brauhaus and several other German-American stores on Lincoln Avenue have closed up shop. Today, it's white, upper-middle-class families enjoying nice restaurants, institutions like Old Town School of Folk Music and the new Sulzer Library, and a renovated Wells Park. Politically, this is the 47th Ward, Ed Kelly's old ward, Gene Shelter's old ward. But so long, Chicago machine, Matt Martin is a new alderman, a progressive representing a progressive neighborhood. What? To give us better insight, we met up with our old friend Mike Fouché. Mike has lived in the hood for over 10 years, and he's been involved in politics and hyper-local news sites for years. He picked the spot, the fabulous Baker Miller Bakery, right on Lincoln Avenue, across from Ricochet's, and right next to the building where I once lived. A good place to discuss Lincoln Square while eating a cheddar and chive scone as the Brown Line rumbles above. We're sitting here in Baker Miller in Lincoln Square, right underneath the L tracks. Mike Fouché, what is Lincoln Square to you?
Oh, man. Well, people in the neighborhood here call it Mayberry in the city. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. You've got a huge little league that's going on in Wells Park. There's lots of involvement in the local schools. There's lots of involvement in the businesses. It's an incredibly walkable neighborhood. You know, some of the best local businesses, incredible store. Harvest Time, probably one of the best grocery stores in town. We've got a first-run movie theater on Lincoln Avenue.
How is that possible? I am personal to this story because 25 years ago I lived in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and then it got better.
Exactly.
After you left.
To hear what you're saying about being a Mayberry in the city and know that it neighbors other neighborhoods that are geographically in the same location. What makes Lincoln Square any different than other neighborhoods?
Well, I think it's got a few things that are going for it. Number one, it's got the Brown Line. The L is right here. And there's actually a lot of stops just in Lincoln Square. I think there's 3 stops. So it's very, very easy to get around. And on the other side, you've got the Metro. So it's very transitable, easy to get downtown. And that's a big draw. I think the other is that we've got the big regional library, Sulzer Library is here. Yeah. That's incredible. It's open a lot more hours than other libraries, and it's huge and has a lot of stuff. Then the Fieldhouse in Wells Park is the story of the Fieldhouse in Wells Park is incredible. It's probably one of the best fieldhouses with a big pool, indoor pool. The way that got built was, the story is that the gymnasium for the St. Queen of Angels across the street burned down, And the park district director at the time, who belonged to Queen of Angels, decided, oh, well, Wells Park is going to take care of that. And they built one of the best field houses in the city. So it has all these incredible resources and things just to start with.
Right.
And then it has, you know, some really nice kind of walkable stuff. I think the square itself is super cute. 20 years ago, when you were here, it was not.
Well,
you know, but
here,
it's gotten
it
better.
Was German.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be predominantly German.
Oh, yeah, it was.
It was like, this is where the German community
yeah.
was, and it's all that heritage and everything,
yeah.
the history that came through with that.
Yeah.
Does this neighborhood go to lengths to honor that history and tradition, or does it get gentrified out like everything else?
I wouldn't use the word gentrified. I'd just say they moved on. It still has Mayfest, which is run by a whole bunch of German neighborhood organizations, but they're not in the neighborhood anymore. If you talk to them, they lament the fact that they all live in the suburbs and they come in. There's the Donk House, but most of the people at the Donk House drive in to go do the
That's
German
a community
stuff.
Center on the, West,
yeah, yeah, huge, like, five-story community center, which is amazing.
Nice,
you know,
yeah.
they have incredible programming there, which everybody should go to. And then there's actually, I can't remember the name of it, but there is a German society that has this one-story building on Lincoln Avenue. And it's a cool place. It's a club. You can't go unless you're a member of the club. But me being me, I just walked in one day and started talking to everybody. And they're like, oh, hey, cool. Somebody who's not 70 years old. And they all glommed on to me. And they're like, oh, you live in the neighborhood? It's like, yes, I do. Do you speak German? No, I don't. Oh, do you have German relatives? No. Oh, well, have a drink. And, you know, I think that was great. But all that has faded away. All those guys in there, they all live out in the suburbs. You ask them where you live. We live in Park Ridge. You know, we live in Elmwood Park.
The one thing I remember about this neighborhood, and continued as I continue to come up here throughout the last 20 years, is that it was an affordable option for city dwellers. Not so much anymore. I mean, you said don't
yeah.
throw the word gentrification around, but the rents here, the property
yeah.
values, everything has gone skyrocketing the last decade.
Definitely not. I mean, my wife and I, we bought our house 13 years ago, and we bought a two-flat, and we like to say we bought the last affordable house on the last affordable block of Lincoln Square. I mean, it. Sorry, guys.
It's over.
It's closed. You know,
this used to be an area that had a lot of rentals along Lincoln Avenue, and in
yep.
some of the areas, this would always, if you looked in the back of the reader, a lot of Giddings,
yep.
a lot of Eastwood, a lot
yep.
of Leland.
Yep.
Not so much anymore.
It's still there. I mean, they go like that. I mean, we've had almost no problems with renting our apartment, but every time that, you know, we do, it's gone in like 4 or 5 days.
So what are the big issues for people who live in this neighborhood? You know, obviously you talk about it being the Mayberry, and there's so many great things that you just pointed out.
Yeah.
What are the issues? What were some of the stuff that played out in the election? But beyond that, what are the things that need to be improved in Lincoln Square?
Nothing. I mean, the Lincoln Square is in the 47th Ward, which had an extraordinary turnout in the congressional races last November. It had an 86% turnout. We're Sweden, is the deal here.
Wow.
I mean, and everybody feels like some kind of obligation or to express themselves and be involved. I mean, it's really hard to say that there's a problem. You know, some people will complain that there's not enough retail shops, but, you know, so what? I mean, there's plenty of retail here. It's not like it is in other parts of the city. You know, we have most everything that you need or could want. I think that probably what's going to become more and more of a problem is affordable housing. And I think the neighborhood is just going to age up and it's going to get more expensive. I grew up in Lincoln Park in the 70s and the 80s, and I remember what Lincoln Park used to be like. It was a working class neighborhood. I had a lot of Puerto Rican neighbors when I first moved in. You know, by the time I left to go to college in the early 90s, that was all gone. It was all Beamers and Mercedes. We used to play street ball when I was little. You couldn't by the time I was a teenager because you'd scratch somebody's European car. So, I mean, I think that's what's going
right.
to end up happening here in Lincoln Square in the next 10 years.
I think about the area, and one thing that was coming in when I was leaving was the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Right.
That is right on Lincoln Avenue. They moved it up from down,
yep.
Lincoln Park.
Yep.
But there's something to be said about a bunch of artists and people from with means, because you got to take
yep.
money to take those banjo lessons.
Right.
But
they came to this neighborhood maybe for the first time,
right,
saw what it could be, and changed it.
Yeah.
I really do believe that that's the spot where this neighborhood changed.
I think that's right. And the Dunk House actually has a lot of super cheap office space. There's a lot of very small theater companies that office in the Dunk House. And there are some other small storefront theaters on Western and Lincoln Avenue that still exist, and I think they're supported because people in the neighborhood want to do that stuff. It's happened. You know, Lincoln Square has happened, and now it's a great place to live and to hang out. I think that north of Lincoln Square and Budlong, I guess that's what they call it, you know, there's still a lot of affordable housing that's there, and that's a great place to live. Albany Park, right over the river. I love living near Albany Park.
Yeah.
You know, Albany Park's the most diverse neighborhood in the city. So there's a lot of stuff that's around it that I think is good.
What are some of the challenges for a neighborhood that's happened?
That's such a good question. You know, I think that there's going to be a struggle about land use and how much of the neighborhood is going to be converted into single families from two flats, and whether or not there's going to be enough density that's going to be allowed. There was a pretty significant, for us, fight over a five-story apartment building on Western Avenue that was built. It was a transit-oriented development, so it didn't have as much parking devoted to it as other places might be. And there was a lot of anger in the neighborhood. Oh, you're going to screw up parking. It didn't. I think that there's going to be a lot of struggle about finding ways to increase density in the neighborhood. I think there's going to be a lot of resistance to that, but that's natural, and it should be the sort of thing that you encourage.
Well, I was going to say, you know, we had this great conversation last week about Woodlawn. And,
right.
And there was Dr. Brazier from the church
yep.
there. And but he made a good point. We were talking about developers aren't going to come into some areas until the neighborhood can support the how much they need to pay.
Right.
You know, if they
right.
get $1,500 for each apartment,
right.
they're not going to come until the neighborhood.
Right.
Lincoln Square could get $1,500 an apartment. So
oh,
the
yeah.
question is,
$2,000.
Right. Do you have to start being concerned as a neighbor and as a member of the community about developers recognizing this is prime land? They're going to try to go sky high. You see how it's what's happening in some of the neighborhoods
yeah.
closer to downtown. They're going to try to make bigger, larger investments to get their money back.
Well, I think that's happened with detached single-family homes. There's a lot of teardowns that are being turned into big $1 million mansions and those sort of things. But the question is the community going to allow development of apartment buildings and building five-story buildings along Western and Lawrence and Ashland and other big streets? I don't know. I think that there's been a resistance to it. And actually, affordable housing was something that was talked about a lot in the aldermanic race. Mm-hmm. And the new alderman, Matt Martin, expressed a lot of support for affordable housing. But there's only so much an alderman can do. You have to be able to assemble the parcel, and you know, you have to figure out a way to make it into a good money-making deal for the developer. Well, we'll see.
Politically, you mentioned Matt Martin. This is the 47th Ward.
Right.
And this is Ed Kelly, Gene
right.
Shelter. There is a legacy
right.
of Chicago political history.
Right. Ed Kelly, the guy that built the field house.
I was going to ask
yeah.
if that was
right.
him. But this is considered Chicago machine territory.
Yeah.
Obviously, the alderman
yeah.
that just left,
yeah.
He changed that a little
yeah.
bit. But do you see... This area went big for Lori Lightfoot. I mean,
yeah.
is this a different political time for Lincoln
oh, yeah.
Square than it was maybe
oh,
10,
yeah.
15, 20 years ago?
That's all gone. That's all gone. I mean, the 47th Ward, the 40th Ward, now that Pat O'Connor has left and Andre Vasquez defeated him. It's now your you know, well-to-do white liberals who, progressives we call ourselves now, I guess I'm one of them, who want to be able to put something into their community and, you know, spend a lot of time and interest doing that sort of thing. They're very devoted to their causes. 85% turnout, I think, is a pretty good case. But they're really not going to take direction from anybody. The local 47th Ward committeeman tried to express support for certain candidates in the aldermanic race, and there was a huge backlash. How dare you tell us what to do? That's undemocratic. And I was like, wow, undemocratic.
That is democratic.
Do you mean voting or the party? I mean, you know, so You know, that was fascinating.
That's funny.
So there is a sense of independence among voters.
Well, my last question to you, Mike, just as we sit here in Lincoln Square on a beautiful day, is this the neighborhood you're going to settle in? Is this it? Do you see yourself staying in Lincoln Square for the rest of your life?
I hope to die here. So get the cleanup crew ready. Is that how I should put it? I don't know. Yeah, it's a terrific place. It's a great place. And I've been trying to get my mother-in-law to move here because it's so walkable. And I know that she would be able to just go and do all the things that she likes to do. You know, I don't really have to drive most of the time if I don't want to. And that's perfect. Good place for old people, Lincoln Square. Come on in.
Mike Fouché at Baker Miller, right there on Lincoln Avenue, where it makes that turn, heart of Lincoln Square. You can find out all our conversations are online at WGNRadio.com. Just search Chicago Neighborhoods or Extension 720. That's going to do it for Extension 720. John Hansen coming up next. We'll talk with him in just a moment before we take our last break. Coming up tomorrow, we're back with another show. We're going to look into the world of performance. The working title right now is Performance Anxiety. Talk with a fear experiment show that's happening at the Park West this weekend. We'll also talk with Calvin Hayden, who's going to be doing the world's largest workout at Wrigley Field on Saturday. And Barbara Gaines from Chicago Shakespeare Theater will join us as well for a conversation about Hamlet. That's all coming up in Extension 720 tomorrow night.